And they succeeded, I think, in many ways of putting down a lot of small organizations that really couldn't afford, you know, to fight a big battle. And I can remember the Lenkert strike, and my husband and I, we walked on the picket line, took our holidays, and we walked on the picket line for the province newspaper strike one year.
That was the late 40s?
Yes. We spent 2 weeks on the picket line. And of course we won that strike, you know, after a long time. The province was never really recovered from that. They lost a lot of subscribers who never took a paper again. And the Sun, of course, was another matter, but you know, we still have the same battles. Nothing has changed. The only thing that has changed now is the approach of organizations towards grievances and towards how they're going to settle them, and how they try to keep away from a strike or a lockout. It's got to that point. It's more subtle.
Mm-hmm.
But the same old battle is still going on. This hasn't changed one bit. It's just more subtle, and they use high-priced lawyers to on each side to arrive at some kind of an agreement. The old boss and worker attitude where they sit across the table from each other, that disappeared after the war, I think. You know, things changed after the war.
Let me just turn the table.
Mm-hmm.
Was this OTEU Local 15 primarily workers for trade unions? People who worked for
They organized the trade union offices. They did that as a first, probably it was one of the first things they did. And then they went from there into the other fields, and the Teamsters were helpful there because they helped to organize the freightways and, you know, the whole business of transportation as far as cartage was concerned. Because we didn't interfere with the other transportation at all. We had girls in offices, like the girl that was in the transit union office. I think she was in the OTU. Yes, she was. And there were girls in other offices of the different unions who were members of the ITU.
Was it
mostly the craft unions, actually? Not too many of the industrial unions. The industrial unions went off and formed their own organizations, like the IWA and the steel workers, the CBFRT. Because the longshoremen, I don't think they have any women in there, not even now.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the other big one? But through all this, we still haven't got anywhere with domestic workers or agricultural workers. It's only a year ago, they talked about doing something for agricultural workers.
The farm
workers organization. We are still in the same struggle. Here it is, 40 years later, you know, 45 years later. And we're still in that same struggle. Those people are still at the bottom level. You know.
Mm-hmm. Was it difficult to organize office workers?
Yeah, because office workers, generally speaking, especially one-girl officers or two-girl officers, they thought they were confidants of the boss. And so they felt themselves to be in a privileged position, and of course unions were out, just like teachers. You know, it was a long time before teachers became oriented towards the labor movement, and of course they left the labor movement with their own federation, but they're still going pretty strong in their own federation, all power to them, you know. But even teachers, you know, thought, well, they were professional people, and so what part did they have to play in unions, you know? It was a long time before they even thought about organizing. It wasn't until that we got the bad legislation coming out of the governments that these people began to rethink their positions.
Right. Did OTEU try and organize any of the large offices in the city?
Yeah. They were mostly dealing, as I can remember, mostly dealing in freightways and some of the larger offices, but they never did really make a big crack in the real estate, insurance, and the banks, which we still have. You know, this, you know, it's pretty difficult. Pretty difficult because most of them are women, and most of them are women who, because now the situation's changing a little bit because there are more women than men, and women are stepping out and leading lives of their own. You know, they're becoming very independent. They don't want to be dependent on a man to keep them anymore. You know, so they have to hold a job. And if they can hold a good job with a boss that they like, and he likes them, they're not going to upset the boat, you know, with union organization. They can stay there and get what they can out of it for themselves. But on the other hand, like the BC Telephone Company is an outstanding example of good union organization. All union employees, both in the mechanical end of it and the operations end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're pretty good. They're strong. And there's no reason at all why that can't happen in other big organizations. Hydro is well organized, and that all came out of the beginnings of office workers saying we want some justice, and we want a good agreement with our employer and a good standard. It all came out of that.
How did OTU organize Hydro? Did they put people in there to organize? Or?
Yeah, I believe so. They had their own office, you see. They were separate from Local 15, so that they did their own job very well. They organized the BC Electric. That was was the beginning, then went into Hydro. And they've always had union organization in the transportation because the street railwaymen were strong, see? But the streetcar drivers and then the bus drivers, they were strong. And then, of course, that also took in the stages, you know, the across Canada buses and the over-the-line buses, you know, the stages, Greyhound, Pacific Stages, they were all in the same thing, too,
mm-hmm.
All organized. All arose out of initial efforts by a few people.
When they were signing up the women who worked in the union offices, did they go around from office to office? And
no.
Oh.
No, they don't do that.
Did the unions themselves assist in that process, or any unions?
The union executives, as far as I know, because I didn't sit closely to them, but as far as I know, their strategy in organizing was to find out where there was dissatisfaction, first of all, by talking to people, and then gradually talking to people who seemed to be interested in union organization and feeding them materials that would show that it was a good thing to belong to a union. And showing the advantages of belonging to a union. That's the way they're working with the bike workers. But they have to do it on a more or less personal one-to-one basis, you know,
mm-hmm.
still. It's still on a personal one-to-one basis. You can't go out and organize a whole block of people unless it's like the building trades, where they say, I have jurisdiction, you know, the building trades has jurisdiction in this area, and the IWA has jurisdiction somewhere else, and all these jurisdictions, and that was the reason that the Canadian Labour Congress set up a special department and a special officer on the executive board to look after structure, because that's what it is. It's so that they can keep peace and ombudsman kind of thing going between these jurisdictions who raid each other, you know. Let's face it, they raid each other once in a while.
Was that happening back then?
Yes.
In the 40s?
Yes.
Were there any? Can you give some examples of raids that took place?
Well, it happened in Hotel Field, and it still happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's happened in the building trades frequently.
Still happens.
Still happens frequently. And not in transportation, though. Not either in public transportation or in freight, where the Teamsters, they've got a pretty tight organization. And, so it doesn't happen there.
Going back to the union label, were you part of a committee that did the work around the union label campaign?
Well, yes. As you know, as secretary treasurer, all those years I had to sort of guide the thing a little bit, and we haven't had too many changes in presidents. George Johnson was a very strong president when I first became interested in the union label. He was a very strong president and had worked with Ed Smith, and so there's a lot of credit to him for getting it off the ground and developing it into what it actually became with the department. And we haven't had too many changes in presidents since then. A lot of strength comes from the printing trades, like the graphic arts and the clothing workers and the service employees and hotel employees, barbers. And there's more of the industrial unions in there now than they used to be. We have fishermen are in, and it took a long time for the fishermen to come into the labor movement. You know, they had battles royal with the Congress, and but they managed to get all that ironed out. And so they are affiliated, two of the locals are affiliated with the Union Labor Trades Council, just two locals. The building trades are pretty strong, and because they're craft unions, you see, so they're interested in the label. There's been quite a move on to, when I was on the executive council of the Union Label Department, to bring in a universal union label, which would stand for all union labels. Mm. And you would see this union label. I don't see where we've got one anywhere. You see, this is the Congress label. There's the Union Label Trades Department, CLC, and there's what we have here. But now they brought out a UL for a while. U and an L, and that was a union label. That was their label. And that didn't seem to work very well. And there was a lot of dissatisfaction from people who had a union label from way back in the 1800s down in the States, internationals. They said, no way are we giving up our union label or our shop guard or our button. That's our insignia of our fight with the employer and the union shop and union conditions, and we're not giving up the label for anybody. So it really wasn't too successful. They do have a union label in the Union Label Trades Department, which has been designed by their designer. But the majority of the delegates that attended the conventions, they said, no way is my organization going to not to take their label anymore, like the printing trades here and others. We are sticking with our own label.
Right. Okay. Were there many other women on the committee, the Union Label Committee?
On the national, you mean?
I guess nationally and provincially.
Yeah, well, Canadian Labour Congress had a number of women while I was in there from the different provinces, representing different provinces. There was men in the Maritimes, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and then we had men in Ontario. Anne Brannock was in Winnipeg, Manitoba. There's a strong committee in Winnipeg. Saskatchewan was kind of weak. There was a you know, a farming community. It was mostly agriculture, so it was not really the work done there that should have been. Alberta, there. There's a lady from Alberta now on the committee. Yes, the women are quite well represented in the union labor movement, actually, both provincially and at the national.
Do you have any ideas why that is, that women got particularly interested?
Well, they were elected, you know, by their caucus at the conventions. It was all done in conventions.
Right.
And over the years, you know, there was this interest built up, and maybe I had some small part in doing this, because at the conventions, I can remember the early conventions of the Canadian Labour Congress. I don't think I was at a convention of the Trades and Labour Congress of Canada.
Right.
I can't remember being at a convention of that body, but I was with the CLC. And I'd be elected by either my own union, or I'd be sent by the Labour Council, or maybe the BC Federation of Labour to represent the organisation. They'd have more than one delegate, you see, maybe four or five delegates, and I'd be one of them. Well, out of that arose my feeling that here, goodness sake, the women had a real clout, you know. And the auxiliaries at that time were very active. There was Transit Auxiliary, there was the Printing Trades Auxiliary, there were the Carpenters, there were about five, and the Fishermen, there were about five, and the IWA, there were about five or six very strong auxiliaries, and they were members of the Union Labour Council. And that too has gone down with the years advancing. They find the auxiliaries haven't got a place anymore. You know, they're good enough still to make coffee and sandwiches for the picket line and so forth, but a lot of those women grew older and they did their job, and no younger women came in.
Right.
Younger women were not interested in doing auxiliary work. They were out working, bringing in that second paycheck. And that's what's been the cause of a lot of women not taking a really active part in trade unions, is because they were too busy with their families at the same time holding a job.
And working in non-organized areas?
Probably, yes, right. And we still have that problem. But anyway, in those early days, we had the help of the auxiliaries, and my part in all of this was, I went to those conventions, and I can remember Claude Jourdan was president. He'd been just newly elected, I think, if I remember rightly. It was the following convention after he was elected the first time. And the executive had moved a constitutional resolution that they raise all the salaries of the executive board of the the Canadian Labour Congress. And to me, this sounded like a very large sum of money that was being asked for all these people, and I was pretty mad about it. And I got to the mic, and I think I was the only woman in that convention who got up to the mic that day and said, well, you know, you can only sleep in one bed at a time, you can only wear one suit of clothes, you can only eat three meals a day, you can only drive one car and live in one house. Why do you need all the other, you know?
Right.
And I didn't get a very good reception for that, because a lot of the guys that were in there thought, oh, well, she's shooting off a lot of words. And they were out for all they could get. They weren't counting the costs, you know. It was more per capita coming out of the trade union guy paying his dues. This is what I said. I said, your money comes out of the dues that are paid into the organization as per capita. So you have to think about that when you raise people's salaries. Your per capita goes up. And no, they didn't seem to mind. They thought I was okay. And so I really made a stab on a lot of things that I thought needed to be brought out in the open, and And I think that's how I got to be interested in women. I used to go around to women and say, God's sake, why don't you get in there and become a delegate, you know? Why don't you be a delegate to your labor council? Why don't you be a delegate to your federation committee and work on committees and then go to the conventions and stand up and have you say your piece, you know?
So you really pushed women to become
active
in the union?
Yes, yeah, I really did. I really did, and I think that's why that both at the federal level and the provincial level, and I have a little plaque from the BC Federation of Labour from the women there to that effect, that I helped to build a women's movement in the labour movement.
Was that because you saw the need for women to be organized?
Yes. Yeah, I saw what happened in the old country, you know. When I left the old country, it was in a very sorry state, and poverty was all around, and my whole background was one that I just felt I had to move somehow to fight the injustices and the conditions that women had to put up with, you know, in those early days. And we still have in factories and factory workers. They're the worst, you know, still are the worst yet, you know. They're exploited, just like domestic workers are exploited and agriculture workers are exploited. They're exploited, and there's going to be more of it with all the new refugees coming into Canada, new Canadian citizens who cannot speak English. They have to go to school. And now we've got Chinese business agents. We've got Chinese people helping at negotiations because of the Chinese coming in stronger and stronger into all these workplaces. So we've got Italians and we've got Chinese, and I suppose we have other nationalities too, you know, who are business agents. I know in the IAA you see a lot of men who are of Indian extraction. The fishermen have Native Indians in there. So we've got all that, you know, we've got all that to consider when you go to a convention, you know. And I must say, I used to get awfully mad, you know. I used to get really mad, and I've never been afraid of anybody. Never really. I'm not afraid of anybody, no matter how high their office is. If I have something to say to them, I go and I say it. And so I suppose that has followed me down through the years, you know, a little bit. But I made a very strong effort to have women well represented in the labor movement at the national and the provincial level.
How about organizing campaigns by the labor movement of areas where women were concentrated? Was there a fight for the unions to go out there and organize?
Well, coming, one I can think of is the fruit and vegetable workers up in our own agricultural area, and up in our Okanagan Valley, and other waypoints. Mm-hmm. That was a strong organization that was put together by women, initially. The women were women business agents in there, and they were the ones who put together a strong fruit and vegetable workers organization, although the men managed it. It was women who pushed for it.
When was that? Was it in the late 40s?
Yes, it would be the 50s, or late 40s anyway.
What about hotel workers? Was that also an area? And restaurant workers, where there was pressure to organize?
Yeah, there's always been an organization in the hotel and restaurant field. But women didn't really take an active part in their organization. They paid their dues, and they did their job, you know. And they felt that was as far as their obligation went, many of them. But now there are more women internationally. And there are more women, I think, in the East of Canada who hold positions in the hotel and restaurant field than there are here in the West. There are some here in the West, of course.
Were there many women who were active in the unions that you were in, the hotel workers and OTU?
You mean active in other ways?
Other than the union label, yeah, who came to meetings, who were shop stewards, who
Well, you know, the organization itself insisted that if they were going to get anywhere, then they had to have shop stewards doing their job, you know, and that happened in the hotels. I mean, they had to be pretty cognizant of what was going on with the housekeeper in the hotel. And they had to be women, there would be a shop steward if it was a large restaurant, you know, where a lot of employees, there would be a shop steward there. But mostly in hotels, and the shop stewards are obligated to do their job. Call meetings, give notices of meetings, and go to the housekeeper if there's a grievance or if there's an injury. And it's another thing, you know, safety programs. Safety programs were, I can remember delegates standing up in the Federation of Labor meetings, the annual conventions, and at the national convention, hammering away at safety measures,
right,
safety programs. And they've come a long way since those early days on safety programs, but we still have a lot to do. Jobs are still not safe, you know.
Were the women who were active in unions, were they mostly single women or married or younger or older? Was there any kind of specific group that was active in terms of age and marital?
Mostly, I would think, from my own experience in the office workers and the hotel people, it would be mostly married women who had come through hard times. The young people sort of took it all for granted, you know. The older generation had fought hard and long to bring about good conditions, but the people that came out of the schools then and took jobs, they took it all for granted. They still do. They take it more for granted all the time that we have holidays with pay, we have statutory holidays paid for, that they have coffee breaks, you know, everything is delegated in the agreement. And they sort of take that for granted. I know a lot of young people who simply give no thought to the fact that that all had to be fought for.
Right.
You know, with much, you know, blood, sweat and tears, really. Yeah, really.
Were there specific issues that came up either within the unions you were involved in or on a convention level that were particularly important to women, like equal pay or maternity leave, child care?
Yeah. That started quite a way back, actually, in the federations of labor, first of all. The unions with the women in them, and I'm thinking now of the IWA, were very strong in, because they had women working in shingle mills, you know, doing in plants, and they were strong on that and getting safety measures and getting maternity leave, and childcare wasn't even talked about in those days, but those two things were safety and maternity leave. And that gradually worked itself into the conventions. There would be resolutions come forward, convention after convention about these different kinds of things for women. Lunchroom facilities, washroom facilities, medical care on the job, you know. Working conditions on the floor.
Right.
And of course recently, very recently, only last year, it came out that women had been putting up with a lot of sexual harassment and never talked about it, you know. And it wasn't until last year that it really hit the floor and in the Women's Committee report. Men knew it was going on, women knew it was going on all those years. And it happens very frequently in the hotel and restaurant business, because, you know, women are close to the boss, you know.